If you would, open your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes. If you can find the book of Psalms in the middle of your Bible, just turn right just a little bit. You'll see Proverbs, and then the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a book that you may be familiar with some of the verses. It also may be a book that you've avoided and not spent much time in. It's one of those books that's been called an anomaly, different. There were some theologians in church history who didn't see how it fit in the Scriptures, for it's so different than any of the other books. Even in my title, I call it The Preacher's Perplexing Problem. It's a mystery book of the Old Testament. Instead of having more of a positive spin on things, having a perspective that, you know, life is great, but it's going to get better, it starts very low and gets worse. I think I can guarantee that Joel Osteen will never preach through this book. It just would not fit his theology. It's down on life early on in the book. And today I want to spend just most of my time just kind of give you a big overview, a big picture of the book. And then starting next week, we'll look at it more verse by verse. Today we'll only deal with the first three verses. But just as a picture, a big picture of the book, I mean, he's down on life. The writer says all is vanity or all is meaningless in it. But then later in the book, he says that you should eat, drink, and be merry. Life is up. It battles the obvious things of life, moves into the questionable areas of life. And it finally, just at the tail end, concludes about the things of God. This book has a significant place in Jewish history and even in today's Jewish practice. Every fall, when the Jews celebrate the Jewish holiday of Sukkot, or better known as the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles, that time of remembering between Exodus and Canaan when they traveled and set up in these little tents. They had temporary place. Well, every year when they celebrate this Feast of Booths, this Feast of Tabernacles, they pull out the book of Kohelet, the Hebrew word for this book, Ecclesiastes. And they'll spend time in the synagogue, even in Israel, every fall, every autumn during the time of the harvest, they'll read the entire book of Ecclesiastes. A couple of reasons I discovered they do this in the tradition of reading it. There's a temporal nature of this book. It echoes the theme of the Feast of Tabernacles, that this place is not our home. We are heading to somewhere else. It also emphasizes death in this book and reflects the time of year that this feast is celebrated, the autumn of life. So the Jews pull out this book, and it's very significant to them. But American culture has also caught on to Ecclesiastes on the wisdom and the writing of it. Herman Melville, author of the famous book Moby Dick, said this about Ecclesiastes. It was on his radar screen. He said this. He said, "Ecclesiastes is the truest of all books." I wouldn't necessarily say that Herman Melville was a great theologian, but Ecclesiastes caught his attention. Thomas Wolfe, another American novelist, short story writer, said this of Ecclesiastes. He says, "For all I have ever seen or learned, this book seems to be, to me, the noblest, the wisest, the most powerful expressions of man's life upon this earth. It's also the highest flower of poetry, eloquence, and truth. He called it the greatest single piece of writing he had ever known, and the wisdom expressed is the most lasting and profound." What Thomas Wolfe said about Ecclesiastes. I throw that out there just to entice you. Maybe you should read the book as we go along. Don't just wait for Sundays to read Ecclesiastes. Be involved in the Word. Take some time. Read the 12 chapters that are provided. Some of you know Ecclesiastes not because of Thomas Wolfe or Herman Melville, You know it because in 1962, Pete Seeger introduced a song called Turn, Turn, Turn. There is a, everything, there is a season. Popularized by the Byrds in 1965, which all, I just want to notice, that predates me. I'm not as old as some of you. Bob Dylan also sang it. It was just taking right out of Ecclesiastes 3, the words there, and putting it to lyrics. The book of Ecclesiastes is a cynical book. And you have to understand that when you're reading through it, that there's a cynicism to it. That the author there is struggling with some thoughts, and he's putting these thoughts together as if he's writing his struggling diary. At times he's even nihilistic, and he has a tendency. And maybe that's why it's one of the most quoted books of the Bible by atheists or religious skeptics, because they can pull verses out and say, see, your God does nothing and life is worthless. Verses such as Ecclesiastes 1:10 seems to appeal to scoffers. I have seen all the works with which has been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, striving after the wind. You ever felt like that? Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 17, So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. You see his despondency, his slight depression, his futile thinking. You see verses like that, and religious skeptics will look at that and quote those for what religion has to offer. But then you see other statements that are so wise and seem to be applicable to God-fearing people, such as Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9 and 10. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls and there is no one to lift him up. Wise. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. He vacillates between futility and what seems to be a celebration of life and wisdom. And you wonder, well, where is he going? What is he saying? What kind of preaching is this from this so-called self-proclaimed preacher? Somewhat convoluted, seemingly contradictory statements in the book of Ecclesiastes confound some. One minute the writer is saying and whining, it appears, that life is unfair, unfulfilling, it makes no sense at all. The next minute he's saying that you should enjoy every minute of your life. You should work hard and you should obey God. Very fascinating. Now, one of the things you need to understand about the book of Ecclesiastes is what type of style or writing it is and where it fits in the flow of all of the Old Testament. Your Bible is basically broke down in the Old Testament. The way the books are numbered there is not chronologically, but by style or emphasis. The first 17 books of your Old Testament are what are known as history books. Genesis all the way to Esther are history books. It's about the history of individuals and primarily the nation of Israel. The next 5 books are what are known as wisdom books, wisdom or poetry books. Job, it's not a history book, it's a poetry or wisdom book. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Those are the 5 books right in the center. The remaining 17 books are the prophets. What we would know as the major and minor prophets. So that's your Old Testament in just a big picture. 17 history books, 5 wisdom poetical books, and 17 prophetical books. They're written differently for different purposes. And you need to understand, when you read through the Old Testament or even the New Testament, there are different genres, different purposes of writing. You don't read the book of Exodus the same way you'd read the book of Job. Just like you would not read a love letter the same way you'd read a legal divorce document. There's a different purpose, a different emphasis. So as we read through Ecclesiastes, you need to understand this is a wisdom book, a poetical book. Sometimes there are things overstated to make an emphasis about something. history and prophecy books tell us mostly about the nation of Israel. The wisdom books deal more with the individual dealing with God. Just to help, and I brought it up just for my library, just because I'd commend it to you, to understand different genres of the book, I would encourage you to pick up this and keep it in your library, a book called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth by Gordon Fee and Douglas Stewart. This is not the Bible. I'm not saying this is great. It's a help to understand different types of writing in the Bible. Now, don't look for this cover. This is like second edition. They've got like the 10th edition out now. Who knows? I got this a long time ago. But it has been a help to read different kinds of literature. It does not interpret this in the Bible for me, but it's letting me know this is the style of writing. Here are some things that you don't want to do or do want to do as you're reading it, such as, and I'll just give you a couple of these, a couple of misuses when reading wisdom literature. One of them they suggest is that people only read a part of the scripture and fail to see the overall message. When Solomon, who I believe wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, makes a bold statement, you've got to understand it in all of the cynicism that he's portraying out. He's not building a theology on one particular verse. He's building out a whole frame of thought to get to a main point. Such as Ecclesiastes chapter 3, when it says there is a time to be born and a time to die. You could take that verse, as some is saying, and say, well, see, God has appointed the day of your birth and the point of the day of your death. Yes, that may be true, but that's not Solomon's emphasis in that verse. He's writing a whole, depressing view of life in general, that it's so temporary. That's his emphasis. It's not to build some obscure doctrine about God's will there. But we take one verse and rip it out of its context. A second misuse of wisdom literature is misunderstanding of terms or categories or the style of literature. When they're overemphasizing something or de-emphasizing something in order to make a point, that's what happens in wisdom literature. With Job, read through the book of Job and you see how his friends blew up some great ideas and Elihu who comes around and says additional things. Or the third misuse of wisdom literature is to fail to follow the entire line of argument through all of the text, therefore misapplying the text because you're not quite sure what is being said. Something else to understand about Ecclesiastes as a book. I think it's kind of interesting for you to know where the names came from. The Old Testament, when it was in the Jewish hands before the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Old Testament was written in Hebrew, primarily from Aramaic, but primarily in Hebrew. During the silent period, what is known as the silent period of history, when God had closed the Old Testament and spoke no more until John the Baptist came. It had no more other prophets. The Jewish people, as the Greek language became more common, the Jewish people, the scholars sat down and translated the Old Testament Hebrew into Greek, which made the Septuagint. At that time, they selected new names for the books. I mentioned this about Genesis not too long ago. Genesis is off a Greek word, meaning origins. It wasn't originally named Genesis. It was the Hebrew word for in the beginning. Well, Ecclesiastes is the same way, that the book of Ecclesiastes was known as the Kolot. But Ecclesiastes is from a Greek word. Okay, you understand, we're in the Old Testament, but we're in the Greek. I don't want to run too fast ahead of here. Ekklesia is a word you may be familiar with in the New Testament. Literally, it's ek, out, and called. It's the called out ones, or the church. Okay, ekklesia, the church. Or more generally known as the assembly, or the gathering. So when you look at Ecclesiastes, it uses the same verbiage here. It doesn't mean the church, it means a gathering or an assembling of ideas. That this preacher in verse 1 of Ecclesiastes chapter 1 is gathering or assembling man's ideas and placing them in this book. I'm gathering all the different thoughts of man in this world. Some that even the author has. Gathering all up and just beginning to examine them. So you understand why they chose the title of the book, Ecclesia, or Ecclesiastes, taking from assembling or gathering. We put a subtitle to this book, I would say, An Assembly of Man's Best Ideas That Lead to Nowhere. This great examination of secular wisdom and knowledge. I know some of that can be a little tedious and a little boring, but I think it's good to understand the book as you go in, how this book is put together. Now, here let me give you the 3 points, taken from verse 1, verse 2, and verse 3. Thinking about where this book is going, you always need to understand when you go into a new book, who wrote it? What was the purpose? And so point number 1 is the preacher. And they use that term because that's what the New American Standard Translation says. In verse 1, it says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Perhaps your translation says the teacher. Either would be synonymous with itself, that there's a preacher. It's the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. Literally, the word preacher or teacher there, the Hebrew word, translates one who gathers, assembles, or collects, which goes directly with the title of the book. There is the gathering ideas. Well, who did the gathering ideas? The preacher, the teacher, the one who gathered these ideas to place them down in this book. So instead of being called a preacher or even a teacher, because he's not trying to teach something, he is just expanding his ideas here, we could call him the searcher for truth. He undergirds that thought in verse 13 of chapter 1. If you look down to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, I set my mind to seek and to explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. There are two phrases that you want to look for in all the book of Ecclesiastes, is under heaven, which is used 3 times, and under the sun, which is used 29 times. There's an emphasis there. He says he's the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. Well, who is that? All of Jewish history, they said it was Solomon. All of the first 18 centuries, it was Solomon in Christian life. Only until higher criticism came around and where we got smarter, or some theologians thought they were, did they start to discount or try to disprove that Solomon wrote it. For no one wanted to accredit Solomon with some of these negative thoughts. But I believe that Solomon did write it, and there is evidence for why I believe that. History, not only standing as a superb position. What about Solomon? Why would he write such a depressing book where he seems, the man with all wisdom, seems not to really capture the essence throughout his whole book until the end about God? Well, if you recall anything about Solomon, in 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 3, it says, now Solomon loved the Lord. This is early in his life. He's taking over the throne from David. Now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father. He starts off pretty good. He's a wise man. If you look back in 1 Kings chapter 3, you'll see that when he prayed for what he desired, the Lord says, ask and I'll give it to you. He doesn't pray for wealth. He doesn't pray for fame. He prays for wisdom. And God grants it to him. And he also gives him wealth and fame. But if you also read very closely, which you should never just skip over words in the Bible, because they're there for a reason. Every jot and tittle has been purchased by the blood of Christ to be put there for you so you understand. It also says that the word except in that same place, that he loved the Lord and he did what was right, except he also took foreign wives, multiple of them. Now, this wasn't because it was romantically involved. Primarily, it was, I'll connect with Egypt, so I will take one of their daughters from the king and marry her, in a sense. It is a contractual agreement between countries. But just because politically things sound right doesn't mean it's biblically correct. And he should not have done that. He also was offering sacrifices on his own, bypassing the priests. A big no-no in Jewish culture, if you would understand the scriptures. So So he was not a perfect man. He had some wisdom, but he also allowed some influences and some wrong actions to take over. And so early in his life, he's starting off somewhat right, but he only deteriorates throughout his life. I guess if you have 700 wives and they all have different gods, somewhere along the way you might be influenced to think less of your God and more highly of theirs. There's the preacher, the son of David, this king in Jerusalem. By 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 9, it says about Solomon, "Now the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord." He was the wealthiest king of all time. I would think that still today he's the wealthiest man that's ever stepped a foot on this planet. He was able to assemble, gather any pleasure, joy, person, anything that his heart or mind desired, he was able to collect it all. And he found that it was meaningless. The very things that some of us strive so hard to attain, to impress with, to find comforts in, Solomon had at his disposal, and he said that it was meaningless. He was able to analyze firsthand life and its purpose. And so what I see here in Ecclesiastes, as you read through the book with me over the next several weeks, is that this is not a man who has come to the table to proclaim some bold message. I see a man who has all the world's pleasures, comforts, right at his fingertips. And he's saying, is this it? And he's writing his frustrations, his perspectives down in this book, directed by God, but to expose the challenge in his own heart, the doubt and disillusionment and even despair that he is going through. Fortunately, as he works through this struggle, he does find a sense of comfort at the end, and he shares that with us at God's direction. That's the preacher. We don't come to this book saying it has all the answers. No, it's showing us the vanity or the meaninglessness or the emptiness of the very things that we still struggle after, but we will find no hope. That leads me into the point two. Verse two is the vanity of vanities, which is the word perplexing. Could you imagine having everything you'd ever want and still finding no meaning in it? Would that be a little perplexing to you? You save up all your life for this, and then they say, that's it? How many of you hope to retire someday where you don't have to work? You're not going to be a Walmart greeter at 87 years old just because you have to, because you banked on social insecurity and found out it really was insecure. All right? That's how people are. They say, I'm going to save up all for this, and then you get it, and then you're like, and the kids run around the green grass, and some people throw a football around, and then some old guy comes around with this bubble things. They put the little soap down there, and he makes these bubbles. And I'm not just talking about the little bubbles you make at home. He makes these mega bubbles. And those are so cool. Anybody remember those mega bubbles? Have you ever seen them? I mean, I don't know how they do it. They make bubbles and they put bubbles inside of bubbles. And it's just huge. And you got like 100 kids floating around trying to touch the bubble. Kids, what happens as soon as you touch that bubble? Boom! His makes noise. It's like boom in our minds. Boom! And where did it go? In verse 2, you could translate it that way. Life is like this big bubble that we're all chasing, and then you touch it and it goes, where? Where'd it go? Kids, it's fun when you're 5 and 7 and 10 trying to chase a bubble, but it's no fun when you're adult, when you finally get to the big bubble you've been searching and you touch it and it's gone. You think, what have I been running around for? This is quite silly. Vanity. Vanity. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. A breath or a vapor, fleeting. It's temporary. It lacks substance. It's easily forgotten. Solomon's going to deal in the book of Ecclesiastes with how we view time, how we interact with the world. He talks about wisdom. He's going to deal with wealth. He's going to even deal with politics. Speak about death, relationships, religion, life transitions, and get to contentment and the Lord at the end. He's going to deal with all of these. He's assembled all the various thoughts. And actually, he's going to repeat himself. He's going to speak about one issue, go to another issue, and then go back to the same issue over and over again. There was a search for the meaning to man's life in this book. It must, even after so many thousands of years since this book was written, it must be still on the high pursuit of many people's life. Almost every time a new book comes out that talks about the purpose of life, man's search for meaning, it's always a bestseller. There are people still searching for why am I here? And so much of it is vanity, emptiness. Looking for the meaning through pleasure, wisdom, work, or wealth. But can we find our purpose in life in self-indulgence? In having property or position, intelligence or philosophy, or even religious observance, which Solomon speaks of in this book? Having all of these things that we could assemble or gather or collect, are these things that give us meaning? We live our lives, and Solomon says, then we die. Death is inescapable and casts a shadow on all we do. He might have said it this way. He might have said that death is the great equalizer. Regardless of how you started and what happens, we all end up in the same place. It's a little frustrating. Straight A students get the same degree that the C students get. Maybe you get an extra tassel, but basically the paper looks about the same. At death, it all looks about the same. I've done 2 funerals in the last 45 days for my own family. Basically the same thing. We come to the end. We honor the people. We love them. And we, in our own way, say goodbye. And Solomon struggles with that. He has all of what the world can provide. And he says, so what? Why does the world promise so much but give ultimately so little? Perplexing, to say the least. Here's the third thing I'll say, is the problem. Verse 3, he goes on, after saying the vanity of vanities are meaningless and meaningless, he says, what advantage? Here's the problem. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? what advantage or what gain, your translation may say, or what profit, what surplus, what excellence, and why do we strive so hard? What does it really come down to for all the work, the toils, the efforts, the labors we put in? Work 50 years for a company to get a gold watch? And who's going to work for a company for 50 years anymore? What company is that loyal to their own employees? Why do we strive so hard? Should we even work if we're all just going to die in the end? Just take up space for our 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, whichever we have, and then just die. I'm seeing depressed faces. Should I be seeing depressed faces? Like, yeah, you're right. I'm quitting tomorrow. I'm going on vacation. Run up the credit cards. They're not coming to me after the grave. In some ways, I don't want to just leave you with a happy thought, go home and just live your life normal tomorrow. I want you to feel the weight of Solomon's struggle here, who has it all. And says, this is it? A man who knew God and had the wisdom of God, but through his life he somehow got distracted and then says, so what? What am I doing? I think the key word here, and I've already mentioned it, is this word under the sun. Let me just make a note here, just real quick. I'll put up the verse on the screen. 1 Corinthians 15:58. Just so I can answer the question, should we even work? I think it's very clear here. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work. And then say the last three words there for me. Of the Lord. There's a big difference. Do we just work? No, we work of the Lord. Knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord. There's a phrase that you need to adapt or adopt into your vocabulary. You go to work tomorrow, you're not working for somebody who's paying you $8 an hour, $15 an hour, $50 an hour, whatever you make. You're working for the Lord. You're a representative of Him. You are an ambassador of the gospel no matter where you are. Perhaps you're just you're a homeschool teacher, or you deliver the mail, or you're a nurse. And people may or may not appreciate what you do, but when you work with excellence because it's of the Lord. You may have to change out a toilet tomorrow for your family because it explodes. Is this work in vain? No, you work for the Lord. You work for the Lord. So now let's go back up to Ecclesiastes 3, or chapter 1, verse 3. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? He seems to be vanity. What advantage is the question? But he frames it in these last three words of that verse. Does under the sun. Most of the entire book of Ecclesiastes is under this phrase, under the sun, or under heaven, but primarily under the sun. Under the sun is the perspective of everything man can see from his perspective. I can look as far this way, or this way, or this way. And in this environment, in this world that I am living in, every natural man can see. Just have common wisdom, common sense. I see. I work really hard and I get this. I attain these things and I get this. Under the sun, what is the purpose? But it's what's over the sun that gives perspective. That's what Solomon was missing in his search until the end. And there's where our society is even today. That we talk about all the things we can gather, and if we can just get this political candidate, or if we can get this job, or if we can just marry that person, or if our kids would be like this. Everything under the sun. If we can just get right, everything will be right. And it's vanity if you don't see what's over the sun. It's really the question. I rephrased it here. I'll put it up on the screen if we haven't. Skip two slides. The next one. Alright, we'll stick there. Okay, go there, yeah. How will you live your life? Under the sun or the sun? Go back to that Mark verse. Jesus said it this way, for what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Now go back to that question I had. It's more than just a play on words. I think it's the whole theology of Ecclesiastes. We live our life under the sun, the things that we can naturally observe, the things that we can see, the things that we pursue. But if we don't have a proper perspective of who controls all and who we should worship, everything is vanity. G. Campbell Morgan said it this way. He's a preacher and a theologian of another generation, but he said it this way, and it captured my thoughts. He says, this man, speaking of the man who wrote this book, Ecclesiastes, speaking of Solomon, this man had been living through all the experiences under the sun. And that's not an exaggeration of comment. He really did expose himself to everything the world had to offer. Solomon had it all. He had been living through all the experiences under the sun, concerned with nothing above the sun, until there came a moment in which he had seen all that life had to offer. There was something over the sun. It is only as a man takes account of that which is over the sun, as well as which is under the sun, that things under the sun are seen in their true light. Great quote by G. Campbell Morgan. Our perspective is so short-sighted, so temporal, and we really need to have a higher perspective. We don't call the things of this world evil in and of themselves. Most of the things in this world are amoral. I was speaking in my class this morning about with the students that about money. Is money evil? And we had a semi-debate on this. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Is money evil? No, money is amoral. It's what you do with it. If I have a brick, is a brick evil? If I throw it through your car window this afternoon, is that evil? What if I use that same brick to build a shelter for people in Honduras? See, there are a lot of things amoral. It doesn't have morality. It's not immoral. It just doesn't have morality. It's just there. It's what we do with it. Many things in this life that Solomon is saying are vanity in and of themselves if not seen in the proper light and perspective of the Father over the Son. So do we live our life with a perspective of only under the sun, or do we live for the sun? Our work is not in vain. It's not toiling in vain when we work in the Lord and we see His perspective. Most of our stress and our tension in life is because of the short vision that we have and the perspective that we have. You are driving through the hills of Tennessee or up in Colorado. You can see very little except you see out in the beauty. But when you're curving around those mountains on those windy roads, you can't see what's ahead of you. You can only see what's right in front of you. And if you're behind one of those semi-trucks that's going super slow, or if you're in rural Missouri where I used to live, behind a big combine, you know, it took up the whole road and you can't see around, should I pass, you would just love to have some perspective about what's ahead. Intention would cease if you had proper, wider, bigger perspective. That's what Solomon was missing in gathering all these things. He needed to tap into God's true wisdom and see His perspective on all things. That's the same thing you and I need.